episode is brought to you by Rockstar's free training class. As always, I only ever recommend services and investments that I would invest in myself, and I have attended this training class at least twice. I've been a consumer of Rockstar's newsletters, events, VIP events, etc. since 2010, and I highly recommend them. Recently, I've been recommending the free training class even more often as I'm finding many new investors, even the highly educated ones with postgraduate degrees, including my brother Tony, who has a higher IQ than me, and my cousin Simon, a professional engineer. They both registered recently and would benefit from fundamental real estate training for beginners. This class is 90 minutes. It will teach you about opportunities to invest in Ontario's Golden Horseshoe. There is no charge, no commitment, and I recommend every investor or entrepreneur take this class at least once. To register, the link is rockstarinnercircle.com/Erwin. Again, that's rockstarinnercircle.com/ERWIN. Hello and welcome, ladies and gentlemen, listeners to the Truth About Real Estate Investing show, where it is my pleasure to bring to you interviews and stories of inspiration, real estate education, and maybe a little entertainment. This week, we are talking to a close friend of mine, John Romanis, a former Torontonian who still works full-time downtown Toronto, and in his part-time, he invests in cash-flowing Hamilton real estate. John's investments are the subject of today's interview, and he started with his first property about 6 years ago, a newer semi-detached house for $234,000 that he rented for $1,500 plus utilities. In today's market, it's worth around $400,000. This house was the first house I recommended to John, and needless to say, I'd call it a home run. John continued to purchase about one house per year, including a new home for himself and expecting wife, Frida, in downtown Burlington. John's a smart guy. He's a successful stock investor as well. He used to teach at Sheridan College. He has his MBA and CPA. And here's the best part. As a part-time investor, John only dedicates about 30 minutes per week to manage his real estate portfolio that generates about $8,000 of rental income. That's 2 hours a month of effort for, or roughly, that's $4,000 per hour that he's generating. How's that for time efficiency? If you want to know how he does it, then stay tuned, and I hope you enjoy the show, for which I suggest turning up the volume, as I'm a bit quiet. But don't worry, I just ordered a new mic and it's already arrived. Without further ado, I'm pleased to announce to you John Romanis. So hello, John. What's keeping you busy these days?
Well, what's not keeping me busy, Erwin? Well, first of all, thanks for having me. For everyone out there, I don't know if they know that I've been chasing you for a while for the opportunity to be on this. So I'm actually quite happy about that. But so what's keeping me busy? First and foremost, I would say work. I think what's pretty cool about what I do is I have a full-time job and I'm a real estate investor. And I think hopefully we'll touch on that a little bit today. And work has certainly been busy quite a lot lately. So that's keeping me running around. As you know, Frida is with child, so looking forward to that. Yeah, thank you very much. So not necessarily keeping me busy yet, but what I'm doing is kind of, I think, storing up all that fresh relaxiness in my head right now so that,
yeah, good luck with that.
6 months from now, it all just kind of evaporates and gone, goes away forever and ever. But yeah, that's what's keeping me busy these days, buddy.
Fantastic. Oh, we're doing something different today. I think, you know, normally Steve last month, it's the first time we did an in-person interview, so we're in person again tonight. I'm actually wearing my pajamas. John's over at my house. We're having some wine. So again, these are all firsts.
Mm-hmm. Erwin looks great in his pajamas.
So can you tell us a bit about yourself?
Yeah, so I live in Burlington. Moved in about a year and a half ago, thanks to you, Erwin, wonderful agent. Been married for about a year and a half now. Like I said, a kid on the way. Prior to this, I lived most of my life in Toronto. So I was born and raised in Toronto, and the work I do is primarily around retail analytics. So won't get into too much details around that. But prior to that, I spent a lot of time in retail and consumer packaged goods. So companies like PepsiCo. A couple of retail companies, Loblaws and Shoppers Drug Mart. Mm-hmm. I have an undergrad in marketing and basically an MBA as well, and I'm also a chartered professional accountant. So, you know, from an investor perspective, I'm definitely not a full-time investor. I have a job, I have a career, I continue to have a career and continue to want to have a career, and the investing that I do is primarily part-time. beyond that, I actually do have some hobbies. I have a black belt in karate. I don't think too many people know that. I try not to tell too many people in case it ever comes to fisticuffs. I just want to have the element of surprise. Erwin's making a face. I've taken up classical guitar lately, right? So there's something. I've been playing guitar since I was 19, on and off, and you know, I find that now in my 40s, I'm gravitating more towards the softer sounds of classical guitar as opposed to the tinnitus causing metal of my yesteryears.
Right. So you're playing acoustic.
Yeah, acoustic and a lot of like classical guitar. So the difference between an acoustic guitar and a classical guitar primarily is acoustic is 6 strings of steel. Classical is 3 strings of steel, 3 strings of nylon, and the strings are slightly wider apart. It's definitely, and even the way you got to sit and hold it, it's a very funny position, but I even bought a footstool and the whole works. So completely back into that and loving it. Absolutely.
Sorry, what's your job title?
So I'm a director of client service.
How many people work for you?
Right now, so it kind of fluctuates. I always count my co-ops because it makes me sound cooler, but I have 10 employees like on a full-time basis plus 2 co-ops. So I guess a total of 12 people reporting to me right now. Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah, it's pretty awesome.
Cool. And you used to teach.
Oh, yeah.
I know it's been a while.
I forgot about that. Thanks for reminding me. So that was a great part of the years back in the day. So I used to teach part time.
When you were single and had more time.
When I was single, I had more time. Truth be told, I'd still be doing it now. It's not necessarily easy finding a part time role. I'll tell you a little bit about that. So about 6 years ago, I'd wanted to teach for a while, but about 6 years ago, I finally had the opportunity to do so, and. I had a boss of mine at the time. He knew somebody who was over at Sheridan College, and I went for an interview, and not long after, I got an offer to teach business math. And with my business background, I was basically able to teach any of the first-year courses. And that was a lot of fun. I think that I ended up teaching business math, I taught business communication, and I taught intro to marketing. And you know what happened, Erwin? Sheridan College actually decided to become a degree-granting institute, right? Mm. So... With my master's degree, I had no problem teaching, you know, undergrads. But when a school goes to become a degree-granting institution, they have to have a certain number of what's called terminal degrees or teachers who have terminal degrees. So what I mean by a terminal degree is a degree that goes as far as it can go, so which in most cases tends to be a PhD. So with my lowly MBA and like 17 years of work experience and real estate experience, I guess I'm not able to teach college students or university students any longer. It's actually kind of sad. But I miss it. I'm still trying to find a role out there. So if anyone in the audience is looking for a passionate, excellent part-time teacher, let me know.
Yeah, for the next 6 months until you're busy.
You know, I got to tell you. I mean, everyone tells me how crazy it's going to be and how I'm going to lose all my sleep. And today I was out for dinner with Frida, and she told me that she was out for lunch with a friend of hers who has a young daughter. And she was reminiscing about the first 3 months, and she said, you know how much fun that is and how the baby is very, I guess, it's not mobile, it's just kind of sitting there. But I mean, you have a lot of time to bond with the baby, to play with the baby. I know the baby doesn't play back, but you just kind of get to know the baby. And you know, it was nice and refreshing to finally hear that someone said the first 3 months were a lot of fun and that you'll never have that time again, as opposed to, oh my God, the first 3 months are a hectic nightmare. And I don't know, I'm more of an optimist. I'm thinking that my baby is going to be a pleasant sleeper, not wake up too much during the night, and his or her poop is going to smell like roses.
Just your kid, John. Can you tell us about your stocks? Like, when we first met, you talked a lot about stocks and how great they were. You still do.
Yeah. So, and you know, this is one thing I love about you is that we can have a good little discussion or debate about this. Because, I mean, I know that, you know, you tend to be, I think, mixed at best, if I can say, about stocks. So I'll tell you a little bit about that.
Well, let's clarify. Like, I think if you know what you're doing,
yeah,
that works.
So,
but if you're going to trust like a mutual fund manager,
oh no,
and
God.
Pay like 2-3%,
yeah,
and just trust them that they can beat the market,
yeah,
like that's not so great. But you've been really successful doing it.
Yeah,
can you elaborate a bit on it?
Yeah, so it started when, again, so I've always been a little bit investment savvy, and I don't know if it's just my character, but I'm going to give my mom some credit for that as well, because I remember when I started working when I was 15, she said to me, if you make $25 a week, and this is now going back to 1991, so $25 was not an immaterial amount, she would say, look, take $10, put it in your pocket, and the rest of it, put it in the bank. So I, from very young, I kind of got into this idea of investing and watching my money grow, and that was exciting. And I didn't know much about stock market until, and oddly enough, I was working in Loblaws in a grocery store, not in head office, back, I don't know, maybe in the late 90s or mid to late 90s. I can't remember exactly when it was. But there was a guy who was working in the deli department who claimed to be putting himself through law school. I don't know. I never went back to actually check on this. And he's like, you know, what are you doing with your money? You should invest it. And I said, well, I have it in the bank. He goes, no. He goes, you got to get in the stock market. Okay, well, how does that work? Mm-hmm. And I remember he said, buy the Loblaws stock. And this was, I mean, the stock must have been $25 a share. And, you know, for those of you who don't know, I mean, it did end up going to about $76 back in 2006. So just giving, you know, it was a good buy, right? And he said, buy, you know, get into the Loblaws stock. And that's how I got into the whole stock market, right? And I remember this was now back in the day where there really wasn't a lot of information on the internet. I used to come into the grocery store every morning and open up the newspaper and go and go down. I know, isn't that funny? I used to go down to the you know, ticker symbol L, because that's what the Loblaw ticker symbol is. And I used to go and see if it was up or down. And it was exciting because I actually had what you would call it, CIBC Investor's Edge. So I was self-directed stocks. But, you know, I got to tell you, Erwin, I made a lot of rookie mistakes. So don't, you know, I'm glad that you recognize that. Yeah, I've done well, and I'll talk about that. But I want to talk more importantly, especially initially, about some of the mistakes I made, right? So the next stock I bought, God, I can't even remember what the second stock was. I think it was a company called Windsor Oil. And it doesn't exist any longer. I actually kind of got in and out of it. I maybe made a little bit of money. But I'll tell you, you know, I was the guy who bought into Nortel. Right, mm-hmm. I bought into Bombardier when it was, you know, mm-hmm. in the 20s, or and I watched it go all the way down. Yeah,
I lost a bunch of money on Bombardier.
I lost a ton of money on Bombardier. Right, I lost a ton of money on Nortel. I remember buying. I think Nortel hit $120 a share at some point, mm-hmm. and I mean, we all know where that ended up going. But I must have bought in I don't know, the 50s or something, mm-hmm. and I literally remember like watching it go down to just nothing. Yeah. Right, and for me, what the lesson in that was. You know, and again, I continued to have success with the Loblaws stock, and then I bought into other stocks like CIBC and a few of the bank stocks, and I'll talk a little bit more about my portfolio now and how it's changed over the years. But I mean, some of the rookie mistakes that people make is I think they just go and they chase whatever's exciting, or one of the things I can't stand is when someone says, well, you know, I buy that product, so I'm going to buy into the stock. But to me, that makes absolutely no sense. Like, I have zero attachment in any way, shape, or form to the stocks that I purchase, other than the fact that they're good companies and I believe in them long term. So, you know, mutual funds, I've been burned on mutual funds. So I don't invest in mutual funds. And again, you know, and for those people out there who may only have, let's say if you have $5,000 or $10,000, having a diversified portfolio with that little money, what are you going to do? Have $1,000 of a particular stock, you know, 10 different stocks at, you know, $1,000 each. So mutual funds make sense. But again, if
you can just mess in Paramount.
Well, we can talk about that because, I mean, you know, for
we'll
all,
get to that later.
For transparency purposes, I obviously have investments with Paramount and Greybrook Capital. So, I mean, I'd love to talk about my experiences with those because they've been exceedingly positive. But when it came to stocks, I actually kind of lucked out somewhere in my mid-20s. I ended up working at head office of Loblaw. And again, up until this point, I had done some dabbling of my own, but it was really on my own, you know, watching, you know, be a business news network or trying to get whatever I could off the internet. But there was a gentleman named Frank that somehow we got into a conversation about stocks. And what he said was that he invests in something, he buys something called the Investment Reporter, or he subscribes to the Investment Reporter.
Oh, okay.
And have you heard of the Investment Reporter?
No.
It is a very conservative, very thoughtful publication that comes out on a weekly basis.
Boring stuff.
Boring.
Yeah.
But I'm not looking for anything exciting. If I told you the list of stocks that I hold, you'd probably fall asleep halfway through. There's nothing super exciting about them, right? But anyways, what the Investment Reporter... So Frank said to me, he goes, hey, I'm going to give you a couple of issues of this Investment Reporter and check it out.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm a buy and hold kind of guy. I'm not the guy looking for the quick dollar. Like, you know, Apple's going up. I'm going to buy in at, you know, $700 a share, and I'm going to get out at $750, and I'm going to buy this. I don't care about that. I want to buy my stocks that I believe in are good long-term investments, mm-hmm. hold on to them, and then when something fundamental changes about that, walk away, right? So the investment reporter really taught me, and it said, look, you know, if you're young and you're looking for growth stocks, here are some of the stocks that you should look at. And it has a very, very consistent, very conservative way of looking at stocks. Right.
Sorry, what was it called again, and where can people get it?
The Investment Reporter. Theinvestmentreporter.com. I think it's like a $350 subscription a year, but every single week on Friday, you get an edition, and it tells you best buys for the month, or it may talk about a particular sector. So in the most recent issue, it's funny, it actually said that it talked about manufacturing stocks, and there's a stock that I've been holding on to for many years, and I had actually bought in and out of it a couple times. Mm-hmm. I would say as far back as 2006, this company called Stella Jones. They make the, you know, in railway tracks, the wood between the between the two rails. Mm-hmm. They make stuff like that and telephone poles. And recently, their company, you know, they the last year or so, their performance wasn't great. And the investment report in the latest issue said, okay, you know what, if you own it, hold it, don't buy anymore, but don't expect it to do well down the road. And for me, you know, that's great advice. Like, as a shareholder, I want to know.
Yeah, for $350, that's pretty cheap advice.
For $350 a year, yeah. That's great advice, right?
Compared to a mutual fund fee.
Yeah. We'll talk about mutual funds in a bit, too. But, you know, I got out of it. Mm-hmm. But what's nice about that, Erwin, in the same edition, it'll say, okay, if you're looking for another manufacturer mm-hmm. to replace this, here's a few other companies that we think are doing really well. So I went into New Flyer Industries, which manufactures buses, right? And you're seeing a proliferation of... you're seeing a proliferation of public transit across major cities in North America. You know, you're seeing with the reduction, trying to reduce pollution now with the current political environment in the U.S. I don't know if it's necessarily been the same. But holistically, right, public transit is becoming more and more increasing.
Sorry.
No, regardless, as, you know, so now I've had the opportunity to go into something different. But it's not because I was chasing something new and interesting. It's because a very conservative publication that I've been following for the last 15 years loyally and that has done really, really well for me has said, look, something fundamental has changed about one of these companies that you're holding. It's time to review your portfolio. Mm-hmm. And that's what I did. Mm-hmm. And Erwin, that's about as much work as I put into my stocks. Every week I read through it. If one of my companies pops up, I'll read about it. If it says everything's great, I don't think about it and I just keep on going.
Right.
So I've got a portfolio of something maybe around 20 different stocks across 5 sectors.
Right. Can you name some of your favorites that you think people should be getting into now?
You know, I'll definitely, but I just want to give a disclaimer again that, hey, anything that you buy is completely up to you and do your own research.
Yeah.
But
for
my own portfolio, a big fan of Canadian National Railway. It's done absolutely well for me. And the nice thing about railroads is they're so diversified in terms of what they haul that any one sector doesn't necessarily crush them, right? When oil, you know, if they're not hauling oil, they're hauling cars. If they're not hauling cars, they're hauling wheat. If they're not hauling wheat, they're hauling coal, right? There's so much that the railways are doing. So Canadian National Railway is by far the best performer I have had over the long term. Absolutely amazing. Stantec, a company that people don't know much about. Erwin's looking at me like, what am I talking about? I guarantee you, Erwin, now that I've told you the name Stantec, you will see the sign everywhere. It's a highly diversified engineering company, one of the largest engineering companies in the world based right here in Canada. With all the work that's going on in the Trump, with all the talk about Trump infrastructure, another company that's poised to grow, doesn't have any of the dirt on it that their major competitor does. What are they called again? They're out of Montreal, the other engineering company that, there was a scandal recently. I can't remember the name of it. Great company. The other one I've had a love-hate relationship is Manulife. Right. You know, with their foray into Asia, building and a lot more people looking for insurance. And that's a company that's affected by interest rates. As interest rates rise, insurers tend to do better. As interest rates fall, insurers tend to do worse. I know we've been in a bit of an interest rate glut lately. Great for real estate investing, but
and stock
investing, right? Because, hey, when interest rates are low, people want to make, you know, it's better to get into a stock and collect dividends.
Versus the bond, yeah.
But dividends, I mean, interest rates are poised to rise. I mean, I don't know if they're going to rise a bit, or astronomically, who knows? But definitely some of the things that that are happening in the United States, I think, are pointing to a period of inflation. I mean, even in Europe, I was just reading that, that, you know, it is a mild inflationary environment.
They got to spend a couple bucks for that wall, though, for Mexico. So let's move on from stocks, because since this is a real estate show.
Absolutely.
So actually, that leads me to the next question. You can answer it if you want or not. So what would your portfolio mix be between stock and real estate?
How would you define portfolio mix? Net assets or net worth?
Because, sure.
I mean, assets, obviously, it's going to be heavily towards real estate because...
Your equity? How about your equity in your real estate versus your...
Well, that's what I'm saying. It's like, equity in real estate versus... I would say 70-30 real estate and stocks.
Wow, you're somebody heavily weighted towards stocks.
Well, yeah, I mean... The portfolio I have, I don't add to it. It basically, I mean, it's been successful. It's a nice hedge, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, real estate will continue to do well. I'm very confident in that. But there's moments when the stock market kicks butt. I mean, last year was a great year. It was up, I think TSX was up. Don't quote me on this. I think it was up 25% or something like that. Like it blew even the Dow Jones out of the water, right? So
what was the real estate market that you're invested in go up?
Well, yeah. And again, the point being that, right? I mean, a 10% rise in the stock market when you're holding $1,000 stock versus a 5% rise in the real estate market when you're holding a $200,000 property is a completely different story. But I will say, Erwin, like, a lot of my stocks are in RRSPs. It's stuff that I've held forever. Mm-hmm. And it's registered. It's a way, you know, I'm keeping it for down the road. It's for a rainy day, whatever it is, right? But real estate, yeah. So I would say 70-30. But keep in mind as well that I also do have some money through work too, right? I mean, it's you know, all the RRSPs and whatnot, right, that my company, you know, I've held on to it. So... some of it, which we can certainly talk about some of the stuff that I've done through you as
well. Right. So I know you're not a financial advisor, but do you think there's a general guideline you would advise between financial markets and real estate?
You know what? The way I would answer that question is based, I would say it all depends on people's risk and like, I guess their appetite for risk and also their willingness to be involved in something like real estate, right? Mm-hmm. So I would say that for a guy like me, I'm completely comfortable with having seven-figure debt to have houses, right? Perfectly comfortable with that. I am perfectly comfortable with watching the stock market fall 20-25% like it did in 2008. Throughout 2008, I didn't sell anything. I just sat there and just said, okay, it's going to come back up, and I bought actually as I was going back up. Mm-hmm. It all depends. Like, can you stand the idea of going through a stock market crash? Can you stand the idea of, you know, can you go to bed at night knowing that you have $1 million or $2 million, depending on who you are, of debt in houses, right? Mm-hmm. So it all depends. So I can't really answer that question on a broad base. For me, I'm far more comfortable having this 70-30 mix, if you will. But for somebody who doesn't, you know, who can't sleep at night thinking about their tenants, and we can talk about this, right? But for people who can't think about, man, is my tenant going to pay, or are they going to put a hole in the wall? I would say your mix should be 0%,
right?
And you're probably better off going and buying a bunch of TransCanada and Enbridge stock and sitting there and collecting a 4 or 5% dividend and not losing any sleep over it. But on the other hand, if you want to, you know, if you want to take a bit of a risk and you want to have a risk reward, like, I don't know. I mean, I got to tell you, the vast majority of the actual return I've made in my portfolio is from buying and holding real estate.
Right. Yeah, a smart guy said to me, it's whoever can deal. So in the context of real estate, because you've dealt with shit.
Yes, I have dealt with Merid.
The advice was, whoever deals with the most shit in real estate wins.
Yeah.
Because if you can hang on, even during the rough spots, you know, holes in drywall.
Oh man,
busted and toilets.
God, I wish that was, you know, that stuff's nothing, right? The holes in the
drywall. Yeah, that's nothing. And when you've been through it, that's nothing.
Yeah.
Right. I have an eviction where I have one tenant who's paying me like $400 a month. My mortgage is like $1,600 a month. The adjudicator just was in favor of tenants. Found a loophole. The loophole didn't even make sense, but they ruled in the favor of the tenant. So I'm stuck holding the keeping that tenant for another 4 months.
Yeah.
Right? But, you know, under this like grand scheme of things, my property has gone up $60,000.
I know. It's amazing, right? I mean, we live in a time and a country where there's so much opportunity in real estate, and I'm fascinated by the number of people who I hear I'm getting into it, or I was thinking of getting into it, but realistically, it's something that small. I think it's a very small percentage of the population, yeah. Right?
So that leads me to my next question, because we're talking about real estate.
Yeah,
you've done well in stocks. Mm-hmm. You've done very well in your career.
Mm-hmm.
Why the decision?
Oh, I
to
love
get
this
into
question.
Why the decision to get into real estate investing?
Real estate investing, just like my story with stocks, goes back a long time. So when I was in my early 20s, and again, this you're going to hear so much about Loblaw because so much of my life revolves around around the number one retailer in Canada. I was working in a grocery store, the same grocery store with that guy who talked to me about buying the Loblaw stock. Also, there was another gentleman who was working there who was part-time there, and I think either studying to become a real estate agent, or he was a real estate agent or starting out, and he's like, let's buy a house together, like an investment property together, right? Now, I must have been all of 22 at the time, right? And I knew that I wanted to get into real estate. I'd always, I'd watch the market go up. Like, you know, my parents bought their house in Toronto, for $220,000 at the peak of the 1980s market.
Wait, sorry, what year?
1988, I believe. Was
89 was actual peak, but, oh. I don't have, maybe December 88 was the peak. And
yeah. No.
But I only have yearly stats. Yeah.
So whatever it was, but you know what I mean? Like, it was right there at the peak.
Just let me interject. The peak price, I believe, was 89. Average Toronto house price was 274.
Yeah. So, and my parents bought 220 or two. I can't remember the exact number, right?
They got a deal.
but the point I'm trying to make, though, is that, I just spoke to my mother the other day, and she wants to sell her house. I mean, she's, my father and her are pushing, she and my father are pushing 70, and they want to move into a more manageable condominium. Mm-hmm. And, they're looking at listing close to 900. I mean, I can't do the math off the top of my head, but that's an incredible ROI. I mean, $200,000, $220,000. So I kind of keep kicking myself in the butt and saying, could you imagine had I bought a couple of rental properties in my early 20s, how much farther along I would have been now? But I mean, hindsight is always 20/20. So, this guy, he's like, hey, let's buy a rental property, and I don't know, it didn't happen. I was that guy, Irwin, back then, who was saying, yeah, I want to do it, and I didn't pull the trigger. And that happened a number of times throughout my life where I considered buying a rental property. There was a time in my life where I had a buddy and I said, hey, listen, you got your own rental place. I'm living in a rental place. Like, why don't we, put our money together and, we'll buy a place. You live upstairs. I'll live downstairs. Yeah. At least we got a property together. We can eventually sell it, make some money, whatever, something. But
and how old were you then?
Probably my early 30s. Okay. Right. So the point is that, There's a number of times I thought about pulling the trigger, but I just wasn't ready. I don't know. Anyway, so I remember somehow I finally got to the point where I said, I really, really want to do this.
Mm-hmm.
And I was pretty adamant about it, right? And actually, before I get to that, I guess the question was, why, in spite of everything else, do I want to do this, right?
Mm-hmm.
And
because you don't really need the money.
Well, I mean, it's not that I need it today, but you don't know what you'll need it for down the road, right?
Right.
And I gotta tell you, man, my real estate affords me a high degree of comfort,
mm-hmm.
knowing that if there were ever an emergency, or if there were, a pause in my employment for, whether I choose to have a pause or whether I'm packaged out. I mean, it's a very fickle employment world these days, right? I mean,
yeah, you're pretty high up. It's not that easy.
It's not easy to find, to replace, a director's income yeah. that easily, right?
Or so, to find an equivalent job.
Exactly. Right? Yeah. So it's nice to have that. If I, I don't want to have to ever sell one of my houses, but if it ever came down to it, I have the comfort of knowing, well, I've got these assets with a ton of equity in them that I could, in the case of an emergency, liquidate, right? But like with anything else, right? I have my stock market, my stock portfolio, which is diversified within it, but holding on to just stocks, you're missing out on a giant opportunity outside of that, right? So in my opinion, real estate really helped to round out my portfolio and expose me to, I think, a little bit more diversification across a couple of different kinds of holdings. So, you know, to answer your question earlier, I mean, in spite of the fact that I had done well in those areas, I wanted further diversification, and I wanted to capitalize on what I thought was a really good opportunity to create a return on equity, a return mm-hmm. on that investment, right? Mm-hmm. So I remember that, I woke up one day and I said, I'm doing this, and I knew in my heart that I was absolutely 100% ready. So what I went and did was, just like with stocks, I went and referred to written material, a book. Mm-hmm. And I went to my local Chapters or my local Indigo with no idea in my mind what I wanted. I went to the real estate or the business section, and I found a book called Real Estate Investing in Canada by mm-hmm. a fine, wonderful individual named Don Campbell. Mm-hmm. And what I loved about Don's perspective on real estate was he was very much about, listen, if you're interested in flipping or making a quick buck, this book's not for you. Mm-hmm. If you are a buy and hold kind of person and you're interested in creating wealth slowly, steadily, and over time, which is what I had become accustomed to with the stocks, mm-hmm. this book is for you.
Right.
So I was like, this is great. Like, this guy is speaking to me personally almost, right? So I read the book, killed it, loved it. Like, I crushed through it. And I remember at the very end, Erwin, it had an advertisement for the RAIN, or the Real Estate Investment Network, ACRE event. Mm-hmm. And I don't remember what year that was. It must have been 7 years ago or so. It wasn't
that
the
long?
Yeah, it was 7 years ago. And I signed up for the ACRE with another buddy of mine named Erwin.
Small world.
and we ended up going to the ACRE, and I loved it. I thought it was brilliant. I mean, it was... You know, I think a lot of these, you hear about people going to real estate events and spending thousands and thousands of dollars, mm-hmm. and at the end of it, they don't really get much. But I got to tell you that I must have spent $700 or $800, and I got, you know, it was the Friday night, all day Saturday, all day Sunday. It was something like 18 to 20 hours of education. And the amount of material and the amount of knowledge I walked away from that day was absolutely, like, it was like drinking water from the proverbial fire hose, right? But what was great about it wasn't all just theoretical stuff. There was a lot of tactical stuff. Like, yeah. I'll never forget, you know, they're saying that, for example, one of the first things curb appeal, right? Make sure that your lawn is taken care of. Make sure that when someone touches the doorknob of your front door, that it's not rickety, that there's a nice, firm, solid doorknob. Yeah. When you walk in, there's no mirror right there staring back at them,
feng
right?
Feng shui, yes.
Right? So there's a number of reasons for that. Like, people don't want to walk in and see themselves when they walk in, or if it's feng shui, or if there's, you know, superstition around it, right? But, I mean, so it ran the gamut from everything of, here's the top towns, and we're going to do an analytic on those towns in Ontario where you should be investing, all the way down to something like, who would have ever thought about doorknobs? Mold, right? Talking about the dangers of mold, talking about grow-ops, talking about legalities, like, I don't know. It was just
Landlord-Tenant Act. Screening tenants.
It was amazing. Like, yeah. It was a lifetime of education crammed into a weekend.
Yeah.
But my adventure still wasn't ready to go yet.
How old were you then?
2007. I got to do the math now. I must have been, 30? I think I was 34.
Okay. Still not ready.
Yeah. Still not ready at 34. I ended up going. So I ended up going and visiting Brantford. I was talking to an agent about investing in Brantford. I think at the time, Brantford was one of the top 10 towns. I don't know why. It was.
Lower in the top 10.
Lower, but,
yeah. But
it was one of the top 10.
Which has since fallen out, but yeah.
Yeah. And we went out and we looked a little bit around, and I was like, okay, you know, this is fine, but I'm not really feeling this, right? Mm-hmm. And again, kind of fell off the radar. I don't know how it happened again. I can't remember if I joined RAIN or if I did another ACRE, but somehow about a year later, I met you, mm-hmm. right? And I don't remember if I had seen you before, but I remember your sport jacket with the Mr. Hamilton logo on it. This was back before you were lean and ripped. You were still slim, but not necessarily lean and ripped.
Yeah, that was before my weightlifting started.
Mm-hmm. Mm. And I can't remember do you remember how we first met?
No, I don't.
I remember our first official meeting, and you asked me to come to Williams. What's it called? Is it Williams Cafe?
Yeah.
But I don't remember which one. And anyway, so you were great in that. I got your card. I either emailed you or called you up, and you were really pushing Hamilton at the time. And if I remember correctly, That year, Hamilton was number two. And I think it's kind of stuck around the number one, number two ever since, correct?
Mm-hmm. So it's top three. It's been top three for the last 5 years.
So, you know, you were promoting yourself, Mr. Hamilton. You had that, you know, the tie cat, the play on the tie cat's jacket, I guess, right? And we went to Williams Pub and we talked about it. Williams Cafe or whatever. And we talked about it and you said, well, what is it that you want to accomplish? You know, what's your exposure to real estate? What's your knowledge about real estate? And I appreciated the fact that you sat down. If we must have sat down for an hour or so and you walked me through, you know, a bunch of questions. I think you were trying to ascertain how serious I was about this. And then that was a pretty cool experience, right? And then I remember you basically said, okay, you know, it sounds like you're looking for something relatively turnkey, relatively easy for your first property, single family, which I'll tell you, single family, the rent isn't necessarily the greatest, but man, they are easy, easy, easy properties to run. Just easy. Like there's no work to it.
Yeah, I love it. And the utilities are in the tenant's name, and we all know where the prices of utilities are going.
Exactly. So you had taken me out to Hamilton, and I think we went and saw five properties or six properties that day. The first of which was a townhouse on the mountain, and then you kind of... Is it a semi?
Yeah. You don't have a neighbor on the other side. You have a neighbor, but...
Well, it's a semi-detached. Yeah, semi-detached. I keep saying townhouse. Well, it's a semi-detached, but it's very vertical-ish, right? Yes, it's a semi-detached, but it has a maintenance fee, so...
Road maintenance fee, yeah.
Road maintenance fee.
Otherwise freehold, yeah.
Otherwise freehold, yes. So, long story short, we went out and looked at all these properties, and we came back to this very first one, and I said, you know what, everyone? Let's just do it.
Yeah.
Right? So we went in and put in an offer. It was a good offer, and and we ended up buying it.
Yeah.
And I remember...
Remember what you paid for it?
I paid $233,500 or $233,400.
We don't do hundreds anymore.
You know, the beauty of this property is that it is virtually identical to its neighbors. So anytime one of its neighbors sells, I'm able to then go and ascertain what the property is worth. And I've seen pretty much anything in the 370 to 390, 400 range over the last few months, which has been just amazing.
233,900.
233,900. What did I say? 234 and change. Not too bad, huh? For that long
ago?
What
do you think it's worth today? So you know pretty well.
I do pretty much well know what it's worth. It's high 300s, 380 to 400, I would say.
I don't know. I think you're Birkin 4.
Yeah. We'll see. Well, you know what? We'll see now in the spring, right? Because it's been a while since one of them has sold. Anyway, but even let's just say for mathematical simplicity, it's 400.
Mm-hmm.
You know? It's about, you know, call it $165,000
right.
ROI.
Right. So aside from the down payment, did you have to put much money into it?
I put my 20% down payment. Forget about legal fees. That stuff is minimal. I did a $3,000 reno on the first floor. Again, just because it was a builder home and the people who had lived there hadn't done anything. I mean, it was still builder-grade paint, builder-grade light fixtures.
Carpet?
There was some ugly carpet on the first floor, had it replaced with laminate. You'd be surprised what a little bit of laminate, a little bit of paint, and a couple new light fixtures will do to spruce up a place, right? People love it. They walk in, they smell fresh paint, and they're like, wow, this is nice. Mm-hmm. So beyond
especially in Hamilton, where they're not used to nice stuff.
Exactly. So beyond that, I haven't had to put very much money into it. It's been turnkey, almost nothing. You know, I mean, I never say no to a repair. I never, like, if a tenant says, you know, can you do this? Or can you know, I've got a little bit of a crack in a wall. Can you come? I'll never say no to that. But I mean, anybody going into this not expecting to spend, $1,000, $2,000 a year in little maintenance is fooling themselves.
Mm-hmm.
You have to be ready to be have to be ready to do that.
Do you remember what you rented it out for originally, and what's the rent now?
The rent now, it's a little bit under market. It's renting for $1,550 or so,
mm-hmm.
which, you know, I could probably get another $150 a month for that.
Mm-hmm.
When I originally rented it out, it was in the low 1400s probably, so it's gone up somewhat. Right. But and again, you know, the carrying cost and I'm, you know, I'm a little bit to blame here. The carrying costs are so low on this property, Irwin, that, you know, I'd rather have it rented steadily mm-hmm. to a family who's going to look after it than, you know, having it on the market for 3-4 months mm-hmm. of vacancy just to collect another $100-$150 a month.
Right.
This place, as soon as it goes up for rent, 2 months later, like, you know, tenants give their 1 month notice or a couple 2 month notice. It's rented for day one. Like, I mean, it's continuously rented.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, it's been a cash cow for me. Yeah. So that was my very first property when you and I went out and did that.
So first time out, you bought a property.
First time out with you, okay. I went out and bought a property. Yes.
That's funny. After all the, you waited. How old were you?
35 at the time, 35. I think. Yeah. So it was a year later, but
so like after like a decade yeah. of inaction,
humming and hawing. And the other thing I didn't mention is, you know, during that time as well. Even after I went to, between the first rain session and when I met you, there was a few people I had talked to about partnering in terms of getting into real estate. Because, you know, I was thinking, you know, it'd be nice to buy a place with another person, share the risk a little bit, you know, have support from them. And what I realized pretty quickly after speaking to a couple people is there's a lot of humming and hawing. This one guy I met at a rain event, really nice guy. You know, we went out for a drink one night, some wings, talked about it. Then I got the whole, oh, my wife's not comfortable. And then I had another guy, oh, you know what, John, let's do this, a buddy of mine. And, you know, great guy. But again, you know, at the end of the day, didn't pull the trigger. And for me, it was frustrating. I was just thinking, how hard can this be? Like, how difficult can it possibly be to buy a house and rent it out and go from there? Mm-hmm. And I realized pretty quickly, not that difficult. So I'm actually really glad that I went into my first few properties. And we can talk about these other properties that I got into. But I'm glad that I went into them on my own.
Well, yeah, you get to keep all the profit.
Yeah.
So the property's gone up $165,000 mm-hmm. as of today.
Mm-hmm.
You have no plans for the house, though. Like, what does that mean to you? Have you thought about that? What does $165,000 mean to you?
Well, I mean...
And this isn't even your only house.
No. Well, I mean, let's... What it means to me is actually, let's go to my next property, and I think you'll get a little bit more of an idea of what it means to me. Stone Church Road.
Stone Church, yeah.
Yeah, so...
Also semi. You love semis.
You know what? Again, semi-detached. It's renting you out for the mid-1500s. Carrying costs were pretty low before. They're much higher now, but I'll explain to you why. It's a positive thing. So when you talk about, you know, what does it mean to you to have a, you know, six-figure increase in the value of a property, you know, Stone Church Road was a great property. We, you know, it was on the market for $230,000, I think. And it had been on the market for 90 days, right? I mean, it didn't show...
Those were the days.
It didn't show well, though. Let's be honest.
It was tired.
It was tired, right? And I remember saying to Irwin, go and offer them 210. What the hell? See what they say.
Yeah.
And they came back at 216, right? And you know...
It was also Christmas.
It was January. Yes, you're right. You're right. It was at the end of the year because I took possession in January of the subsequent year. So this was 6 months after my first property, by the way, mm-hmm. right? So 6 months after
a decade of
after doing nothing. So I bought this property, and the first thing I did was dump $20,000 into renovations, right? And again, you know, it had you know, the, you know, when you look in more modern homes, they have white trim around the doorways and white baseboards. This had the old kind of neutral color or sort of like beige color wood. I don't know what that one. I'm not.
Yeah, it was naked wood color.
Yeah, exactly. Right.
Yeah.
Closet doors were all dilapidated. You know, the tile wasn't nice. The washrooms were gross. So I said, look, you know, let's redo all the trim in the house, all the baseboards, all the trim around the doors,
new bathroom
in the upstairs, complete repainting of the house. And it brought it all to life, right? Light fixtures, you know, the heating grates, all that stuff, believe it or not, makes a huge difference in terms of the way people perceive the house, right? I don't think I needed to. It didn't have carpet in the upstairs. It did in the downstairs. I didn't replace that yet. I have a...
Oh, really?
I have a different... But I have a... Erwin, this property cannot stop being rented. As soon as it's done renting, so like, I mean, I've had the people in there now have just been wonderful. They've been there for a few years. They've taken care of it. There's been no indication that they want to go anywhere.
Right.
But I have a plan for this place. So anyways, I recently refinanced it
mm-hmm.
and pulled out $105,000 from the property.
Mm-hmm.
So when you talk about what it means...
Bank handed you six figures.
Yeah, I remember taking a snapshot of the account and sending it to Frida and saying, look what my bank account looks like.
All the financial advisors didn't call you?
Oh, man.
I'm pretty sure that triggers something and they start calling.
Well, you know what I ended up doing is I had a line of credit for a property that I bought more recently at a higher rate of interest, so I paid most of that down. I paid off my personal vehicle, so You know, no more, no more vehicular debt. And then, the, and then I kind of put some of the money aside for other purposes, right?
I miss not having car payments.
Oh well, at least you can you can taxify your
true.
Yeah. So yeah, I mean that was my second property. So you know, going back to Venio, or the first property that I bought, I have the equity in the form of a line of credit. So if I ever want to borrow that money, it's sitting there waiting for me to do whatever I want. So
and how much is the line of credit?
It's six figures.
Nice.
yeah. So it's pretty good. I'm not complaining about that.
Nice.
So
and just sort of just wanted to offer a quick tip on that, in case the market ever turns. It's happened, I believe, in the States where during the credit crisis. They wouldn't demand that you give the money back, but they would take your credit limit away.
Yeah.
Yeah. So in case that ever happens, you feel the market's turning, you take that line of credit money, should you choose to, and put it in a different bank.
Yeah, exactly.
So they can't touch it.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, I mean, hopefully we won't see that. I mean, I don't know if
it's happened in the
U.S., but I don't know if it's happened here.
No, not that I'm aware of.
Yeah. So, do we want to go into the next question, or do you want me to talk to you about my interesting property number three, which would have been First Avenue in Welland?
So, sorry, what question I wanted to ask was, how many properties do you have now?
Well, I am owner of five, two of which I share with a very lovely friend of mine.
Right. And part of the point of this episode was I wanted to give, it's because of all the episodes we've given, I think we're on episode 16 right now, the 15 previous guests we're all full-time in real estate investment.
Yeah.
Either in their businesses or they are investors full-time.
Yeah.
Except for Chris actually. And Evelyn, she's still working her job. But my point being is that you're not individually, you're not independently wealthy. Can you touch on that? Like your parents, immigrants?
My parents are immigrants. My mom's from the Middle East. My father's from Greece.
Not those rich immigrants, like the Chinese immigrants.
No.
John's Greek, by the way.
my father came here with a grade 6 education. Yeah. He played in a Greek band for many years to put money in the bank and food on the table. My mother worked for OHIP briefly, and then quit when she had me. I keep thinking to this day, man, what a nice government pension she would have had if she stuck around. But my parents were the true immigrant story. Came here with no money. I mean, I paid my way through university. I'm thankful to my wonderful parents. I got to live at home for free, and they fed me and took care of me while I was going to school. But pretty much after that, everything else was paying my way. And
yeah.
I mean, everything that I started with in terms of my real estate investing was from just, my paycheck.
Yeah.
Right. So none
You're
of it.
You're so self-made man is my point.
Yeah. I guess as much as a self-made person could be. Having supportive family, right? It's not like I was
Well, you're not like Trump and you're handing $1 million back in the whatever.
Million? Wasn't it more like 50?
Was it 50?
I don't know. Who knows?
And he calls himself a self-made man.
Yeah, sure he is.
But the point is, my point being is that you weren't handed anything. You weren't given anything. You worked for everything.
Yep.
You've had to overcome your own hurdles.
Well, yeah.
To figure this out and be a very successful investor. Part-time.
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 We should talk about how one manages a portfolio of five properties while working full time.
Yes, actually. So before you say that, how many hours per week or per month do you think you spend?
You know what?
And then how much revenue do you generate in that same amount of time?
Yeah.
And then if you can give an hourly rate.
Yeah, I would say. I probably spend half hour a week.
Okay.
What else
so
do I have to do?
2 hours a month?
Yeah, so call it two hours a month.
And then how much rent comes in a month?
9,000? No, I'm exact. It'll be maybe $8,000 a month.
So 8,000 for 2 hours a month.
Yeah.
So that's a $4,000 an hour rent.
Yeah.
Okay.
Try to wrap your head around that.
Yeah. So, and if you really suffer for those 2 hours, right?
Yeah.
It's like people are like beating on you.
And keep in mind, and the majority of those 2 hours, like I could outsource. I just, it's mostly just processing bills and managing my statement. Like I have an Excel statement where I manage all my income and expenses and all that other stuff.
Yes.
I mean, I could outsource that to a bookkeeper and have them do that. And my amount of time would go down to maybe half an hour a month instead of 2 hours. But I love managing the financial part of it. I love the bills. I love seeing the money coming in and out. That's exciting to me.
Right. So, okay. So you're making $4,000 an hour. I'm trying to work for like $500 an hour. So for those of you who are listening, what are you willing to do to make generate $4,000 of revenue per hour? Because I know a lot of you make 30, 60, 80 if you do really well, $100 an hour if you do really, really well, because that puts you almost into the top 1%. But we're talking here, John, pretty average guy. No, John's a little bit above average, as you can tell. He's got his MBA and he's a CA as well.
But yeah, CPA.
$4,000 an hour. Thank you, John. Where were we going?
I think we had mentioned the fact that, you wanted to ask a little bit about how I manage this portfolio,
yes.
Right?
Yes.
Yeah, so...
So the rest of the part, all like the fixing of toilets and the all collecting of rent.
Yeah.
And who does all that for you?
So I think right from early on, I established very quickly that I'm not the guy who needs to deal with tenants, right? I'll be very frank with you. I'm not only do I not have the time, I have nor do I have the desire, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I'm a people person. I love working with people. I mean, you know, I have a big team at the office. I'm energized. I love working with others. I'm very, you know, extroverted and but the idea of, you know, having to knock on someone's door and say, "Where's my rent?" Or while I'm sleeping, you know, getting ready for a big day at the office and having my phone go off at 3 a.m. and, you know, hey, a pipe burst or the toilet's not flushing or whatever. That to me is a nightmare. And I'll tell you, Erwin, even if I were retired, I still would not be managing that. So I knew very, very quickly that I had to build my team. And I know you stress this in your meetings, and until you start experiencing it for yourself, you don't realize how important your team is, right? So I have property managers, and I say managers because there's two managers I work with.
Right.
So I have one property manager on my single family.
Sorry, can you give them a shout out?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. So I work with Cornerstone on my single family properties, and I've been working with Jeff and the Cornerstone family since I started in this. So you know, it's been great, and I also work with Roger Auger on my student rentals and my triplex in Hamilton. So and again, both organizations are great. They've certainly come a long, long way since their beginnings, right? Process wise, responsiveness, customer service wise. So you know, I mean, I couldn't have done it without these guys. And I got to tell you, man, that you know, as much as they've done for me, like I've, you know, there's times where I have to harass them a little bit or chase after certain responses or whatever. But they always come through for me. So
right.
I mean,
you're making $4,000 an hour, so it's not that.
Listen,
too bad to go after.
You know, waking up and going to the office and having to send a note at like 7:30 to Roger and saying, hey, can you tell me what the status of this person's rent is? You know, that's a 5-minute email. I'd rather do that than have to get in the car after work, drive to the tenant, ask them, hopefully they're home.
At the peak,
right?
At the peak of rush hour.
Peak of rush hour, and then come back again. I mean, and you know, every time I get that property management bill each month, and the bills are very reasonable, you know, depending on the kind of property, they range from 8 to 10% plus HST.
Mm-hmm.
I'll tell you, man, like it's one of those bills where I get it every month and I'm so thankful and so happy to pay it. The only other bill that I feel that way about is the 407 bill. Every single month when I think about how many hours of my life the 407 has given back to me, I am so thankful for that.
How much that thing costs.
I don't care how much the 407 costs. I love it.
Yeah. Well, at least we didn't have to pay to build the thing. And
yeah.
We can rent it out for a short period of time. And for the listeners, that's cornerstoneselect.ca and augerproperties.ca, I believe. That's AUGER properties.ca.
Yeah.
I'll include both in the show notes.
Yeah. So, I mean, so I have my relationship with certainly my property managers. And let's be honest. I mean, outside of purchasing the house, like, you know, your real estate agent is an amazing resource for the purchase of a house. you know, for understanding what else is out there, for keeping you abreast of what's happening in terms of new listings and whatnot. I'm talking about your average agent. I'm not talking about you. Obviously, that we have you and I have a very different relationship. Mm-hmm. But your property manager is really the face of your operation. So, number one, I would say be very cognizant that your property manager is also an investor, right? Mm-hmm. And not just an investor, but somebody who is passionate about what they do. Like, there's a lot of crappy property managers out there.
And realtors.
And realtors, right? I mean, when I bought my triplex on Myrtle Avenue in Hamilton, it's a triplex. It was $295,000, which is a joke. I can't believe that, that I picked up a legal non-conforming triplex in Hamilton.
Just a quick point. All these properties we talked about were on MLS, so anyone could have them.
I can't believe it. We only had one other offer on this. It's unbelievable. Do you know what that place is probably worth now? $450,000 maybe? And this is one of my more recent properties. I bought it while I was with my wife.
More
than $450,000?
I saw a crappy looking one on a bad street for over $500,000.
There you go. Yeah. That property is ridiculous how much it's gone up.
And the thing was, because I was listing it, so my client was selling that house. I sent that to all the top realtors in Hamilton that work with investors. None of them showed it.
I couldn't believe it. Like, it was, you know, but
legal. Like, everyone should have wanted that house.
The point I was trying to make about property management is you have this property and it had three levels, and the former property manager had basically the middle floor empty, and she had reduced the rent of the upstairs tenant. Reduced the rent to try to keep the tenant. Yeah. Like, what?
Where the vacancy rate is. Like,
what kind of property manager reduces rent when, the vacancy rate is this tight and property values are going up? I mean, I'm at the point now where I'm actually looking forward to having some churn so I can take prices up a little bit, right? Because, you know, as you know, you can only take them up so much when you have tenants in the house. I mean, I'm thankful for my tenants. I love them. They're great. But, you know, the only way you're going to really be able to make a little bit more money in a tight market like this is when your tenants churn. Okay. And my property managers have been so great filling houses with such great tenants that I'm not getting any of that churn. So it's been a bit of a double-edged sword.
I just want to make that point that, especially novice investors, they're so fearful of vacancy.
Oh, God.
Whereas that you are welcoming it.
Mm-hmm. You know what? It's just healthy churn, right? It gives you an opportunity to reassess what the tenant profile should be.
Adjust to the market price.
And you know what? It gives you the opportunity to leave the property off the market for a month, clean it up, repaint it, throw some new carpet in, put some laminate flooring, change the light fixtures, you know, spend a few thousand bucks and have it brand spanking new and get that return on that investment, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that's the point I was making earlier. Is, again, property manager, you got to be very careful. They got to have some skin in the game. They got to care about your property. They got to care about your business. And I've been lucky in that. My property managers, they're, like I said, beyond being responsive, they really do genuinely care about me and my property. So I'm thankful for that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Can you give some tips then? Like, how do you get buy-in from the property manager?
Well,
because I see this mistake made a lot. I think you probably know that people make this mistake.
Yep.
Like, beating up on their PMs.
Yep.
Like, treating them like they're slaves.
Oh, God. So the first things first is the way I look at it is okay. So I'm a manager at work. I have 12 employees, right?
So you understand managing people and keeping them motivated and keeping them employed.
You know, at the end of the day, there's a famous quote that says, you don't build a business, you build people, and they build a business for you, right? So I do my best to try to develop my team to make sure they're happy, to get what they need in order to build the business at work. I want to make sure that my property manager, when he or one, I say he because they're both men, but their teams are a mix. But when he or she, one of their contacts, gets an email from me, I want them to be like, okay, hey, it's great, it's John. You know, he's thankful, he's appreciative. Not, oh man, there's that guy again harassing us. Like, there have been times, like, you know, Roger will tell you as an example. I've bickered with him before, and I've sent him some snarky emails. But the next day, I'm on the phone apologizing. I love Roger. He's a sweet guy, right? At the end of the day,
also because you need him. Like, that's partly why you're sweet to him. Well, you're a nice guy too, but
Well, yeah, but I mean,
you can't just always use the whip.
No, no.
On people that you need.
No, no, but I do need Roger, yeah. Right? He's the face of my business. He and his team are the face of my business. Jeff and his team are the face of my business, right? And if the face of my business is unhappy, how can my customers be happy, right? So your property manager, besides having a good property manager, you have to treat them like gold, right? You know, be appreciative. You know, if they're not responsive, you know, you can follow up with them, but don't treat them rudely, right? Have some faith in them. That's the biggest one, Erwin, is that I find it funny that people hire property managers and then they try to micromanage them. Why do you want to micromanage somebody that you're paying to do a job?
Right.
It seems counterintuitive. You don't hire good people and then tell them how to do their job. You hire good people because you have to trust that they're going to do that job. And listen, if they're not doing their job, you have a discussion with them. You set expectations. If they don't meet those expectations, then move on.
Yeah.
But don't hire someone and then sit there and try to make sure that every single little thing they're doing is exactly perfect and to your schedule and how you want it, right?
But I mean, advice, though, before you move on is that you can find someone that meets your expectations, because maybe your expectations are, maybe they are reasonable, maybe they're not. End of the day, though, you still need someone to do that job.
Yeah.
And you don't want that really, you don't really want that person to be you.
No. I mean, yeah. So I have the relationship with my property managers, got my relationship with you, right? I mean, I'll tell everyone, every property, with the exception of my condo that I bought, my very first place where I lived, with the exception of that, every single property, including the one I live in with my wife, I purchased through you.
Yeah.
So obviously, you know, having a great real estate agent who you trust. And Erwin, do you want to tell the story of how I bought my property
sure.
that I live in right now? How much trust I have in you and my wife.
Yeah, you weren't even present.
Yeah. Yeah. So you went out to a bunch of properties in Burlington with Frida. You basically FaceTimed me while she walked through the properties with her, you know, with you, I should say. And she was like, this is the one I like. I'm like, all right, I'll come and look at it. So I drove out to Burlington, looked at it. I said, do you like it? Yeah. And I said, all right, let's buy it. And that was pretty much it. If I remember.
You saw it before the inspection? I forget.
I don't. Yeah, I did see it before the I think. I don't remember. Anyway, point being is that, you know, you got us an amazing house, and I completely trusted you and Frida to make that decision.
And how much did it go up in value? And it was a scary experience for Frida because it was her first house ever versus you and I had done.
Oh my god.
How many houses had you and I done before that? 4 or 5?
Well, the 4
houses before this one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Then
so
that
we had a good working relationship.
Yeah.
This was Frida's first house, period.
Yeah.
Didn't know me that well, admittedly.
No. And now we're all friends. But it's gone up. It's gone up again. I mean, it's almost embarrassing to say in a year and a half. It's probably gone up 140,000, 150,000.
Well, that's a good payday.
It's unbelievable. Burlington is something else.
Downtown Burlington.
Downtown Burlington is something else. Yeah.
Because it's a fabulous location.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's why I love the house.
I'm still fascinated. Like, Frida will still say to me, I can't believe we found this house in downtown Burlington and live in downtown Burlington.
Yeah.
It's unbelievable. I mean, the summertime's going down to the water, going for walks.
Yeah, wait till you have kids.
Yeah, that's, well, the park, you know what, Spencer Smith Park, we've gone there and played with Robin and Bruce a number of times,
yeah.
Right? And you come down to our house, we walk down together, right?
You'll be ice rinking this winter. It'll be awesome.
Yeah, well, yeah, down the road, right?
And actually, while we're on the topic of your house,
yeah,
let's share that lesson about the whole severing the lot. Do you want me to tell?
Yeah, so we had a bit of a funny experience when we were buying the house, right?
Because it
hadn't sold. There was 2 offers on it before my offer, I believe. And they rescinded. They actually pulled the offers. And I think it was because my house and the one next to it, the owner was the same owner. So what ended up happening is they ended up becoming melded into one big property.
Yeah.
Like and if I recall correctly, because what they had done was they had used the wrong kind of lawyer. They
used a relative.
A relative, but who was the relative lawyer?
The wife's father.
Ah.
But he wasn't in real estate law.
That's what I'm saying. He was the wrong kind of lawyer. He wasn't a real estate lawyer.
But it was someone's dad.
Yeah. So it ended up costing, what, $10,000?
It was $10,000.
To re-split the properties before they could sell it?
$10,000 just in like paperwork.
Isn't that, there's no value in that.
In a survey.
Yeah. Yeah, there's no value
for
nothing, in that.
For no value.
No, no, no. But I mean, like,
and that's what, and but that we got lucky because if not for that, that probably, house probably wouldn't have been there.
I agree, but and the lesson in what you're saying is actually twofold. Number one, when it comes to anything legal, right? Make sure you are not pinching the pennies, yeah. Right? Like, I mean,
it's, they probably saved like $1,000 using dad, and it cost them $10,000.
Yeah. And number two, of course, do your research, right? I mean, if you're planning on buying two properties next to one another, we are literally on the same street as City Hall. It was a 5-minute walk to City Hall and say, listen, I'm planning on buying the property next door. Are there any potential ramifications I should be aware of?
But you're talking to a lawyer it is what it is.
So, Rowan, if I remember correctly,
You won.
You had a couple of really good questions in here I wanted to answer as well toward the end. I think there's one about condominiums.
Yes, that's actually the next question. Oh. So you're not a fan of condominiums.
You know what? And I can't wrap my head around condominiums. So
that bad. And you lived one. Oh. You lived in one for how long?
It was 5 years, 6 years. I can't remember. I think 5 or 6 years, right?
In the west end of Toronto.
I gotta tell you, there's condominiums have their benefits and they have their drawbacks, right?
Yeah, convenient.
Benefits are convenient. Like I had underground parking. I didn't have to mow the lawn. I didn't have to clean the leaves. I still don't now because I have someone do it for me. But you know what I mean. I could have had to do those things, right?
Were utilities included in the
utilities were all included except internet. So I mean, you have the convenience of all that, right? But let me tell you the experience of this. So when I moved in, first of all, my condo fees were $450 a month.
Ooh, that's pretty steep already.
Well, no, because remember, they included everything. They included TV, heat, water, TV. Electricity. Okay. And it wasn't just regular TV. It was like HD TV with like a plethora of channels. Like it was a TV watcher's daydream, right? Mm-hmm. So when I moved in, it was $450 a month. And you remember that not long after that, the government decided that they were going to put the HST portion. I think it was just GS. Like it was one of the two taxes only on maintenance fees, and then the other tax got kicked in. So right away, everyone's maintenance fees went up by 7 or 8% because of the incremental tax. And then there was like reassessments and this. By the time I moved out, 5 or 6 years later, my maintenance fees were $650 a month. Like they basically went up 50% in 5 or 6 years. And for what? What incremental value did I get for that, right? And Erwin, there's an inverse relationship between property value increase and maintenance fee increase. Yes. So
because it hurts your affordability.
Absolutely. So I bought my condo for $254,000, which...
In the year?
The year I was, 35... I don't know, six or 7 years ago, whatever it was. So
square footage?
700.
Okay.
Yeah, right. I probably overpaid a little bit in that, I admit, right? Rookie mistake. I was working with a part-time real estate agent. Like, again, nice guy, but just didn't do his research or didn't care to tell me, like, you're probably paying $20,000 or $30,000 more for this than you should, right?
Okay.
Yeah. So I bought the place for $254,000. I must have spent between new appliances, because the appliances were old. There was no blinds. You know, the closets were old. Everything was old. I probably spent $20,000 over the 5 years there to do all sorts of nice work and modernize the place, right? You know, new dishwasher, new stove, new fridge, new washer, new dryer, new shower door, which believe it or not, like a floating shower door was not cheap. All new closets with like everything like, you know, California style closets, mm-hmm. new closet doors, new blinds, complete paint job. All that I did over 5 years. Do you know how much I sold the property for? $255,000. $1,000 more. No.
You made money.
I made $1,000.
That's good.
My God. It is a huge ROI. But
you had to pay fees.
It wasn't just the maintenance fees. That's just part of it. If it were just the maintenance fees, I would have been doing shots on the way out of the place. What ended up happening is... So this condominium, it was in three... So you know when you have a condominium, you have a condominium board, which is usually full of not the greatest people, okay? That's been my opinion and, you know, so far from what I've seen. But this building, it was being built during a time of recession. So what ended up happening, instead of having one giant complex with one condo board, they ended up doing it in segments. So they completed a building It got a condo board. They completed the second segment. It had its own condo board. They completed the third segment. It had its own condo board, right?
Yeah.
So we had three condo boards, but we had shared services. We had one parking lot.
Yeah.
We had one pool, one gym, one air conditioner to power all three buildings. But three boards, right? So what ended up happening
is that the kitchen.
The air conditioner of the three buildings, like the big massive air conditioner, was sitting on top of one of the buildings with the most population. And it started to leak into the penthouse of a particularly prickly individual who happened to be a lawyer, who then was also on the board, who then decided to sue the other two boards for control of the common elements. Keep in mind that the parking structure, for example, was beneath all the structures, right? And that the heating unit or whatever it was on top of our building. But we weren't saying, hey, we want control of that, or we want control of the parking structure component that's under our building. So he was trying to sue for control of the common elements because he was pissed off that the air conditioner was leaking to his building. So imagine, this is now, you know, I'm engaged to my wife, engaged to my girlfriend, my fiance at the time, Frida. And I'm going, my God, like I got to sell this place and I got to buy something to go move in with my wife in Burlington. She's from Hamilton. I can't get married to her and then either have her drive to Hamilton for work or me drive to Toronto for work. Like, this isn't going to work, right? Imagine trying to sell your condominium while trying to explain to people that you're paying $650 a month in maintenance fees. And then on top of that, oh, by the way, there's legal issues and you may have to pay a one-time fee to settle that down the road. Right? Never again. If you want to live in a condominium because you want the lifestyle, my advice is rent. Just rent and don't worry about anything.
Right.
If your landlord wants to own the condo and have all the headaches associated with that, more power to him or her. Enjoy the rental.
Right. And I think it's something that investors, investors who've never owned a condo, do not understand that the condo board is actually a risk factor.
Oh, it's terrible. And again, like...
Because who has free time to be on the board, really?
I don't know. You know, I mean, in our building, it tended to be retirees, right?
and their requirements are usually probably different than yours, depending on your age.
The only thing I'll say about condos, again, I mean, you'll find some investors out there who are tremendously successful with condominiums, and that's fine, right? I just don't like the idea of my financial well-being in the hand of a part-time board who isn't necessarily trained to run a condominium. Like, that's scary, right?
Mm-hmm.
To me, that's terrifying.
Mm-hmm.
But to each their own.
I have to say that I'm in the same boat. I'm not trusting of other people to manage my investments, which is why I prefer freehold, why you own strictly freehold right now. And I've always advised people to own freehold. Historically, freehold has outperformed condominium. So for a lot of reasons, it makes a lot of sense.
Yep, I concur.
So let's get back to your portfolio because I want to take up. We're past
yeah.
the time that I promised you. How much do you think your net worth has improved by investing in real estate?
Oh, man. Well... You know, without kind of getting into the too much of the numbers, I mean it's obviously well into the six figures, right?
One house was six figures.
Yeah. So I bought a property last July, so I mean don't think too much about that. But I mean the rest of them you can kind of extrapolate on, right?
So what, $600,000?
I think that's fairish.
Five properties?
Yeah, the latest property again is, you know, I mean, bought it in July. I mean, how much? It's gone up, but I mean, I don't think too much about that one. I really think about the ones that I've held for a number of years. But yeah, I think that's about a fair number.
Right. Man, after like 10 plus years of investing.
Could you imagine? I keep saying to Frida, if I had started when I was in my 20s, I wouldn't even have bothered doing an MBA.
Yeah.
I would have just basically kept putting money in properties and I'd probably retired by now.
And the point that I make to investors, so the biggest wreck that we are well aware of in the real estate market for Toronto, the peak price was about 274. I mentioned that earlier. Are you okay owning a house for 274 in Toronto? So you bought at the peak,
yeah.
274 in
yeah.
1989.
Yeah.
Are you okay with
it? Yeah, you know what? Mm-hmm. I think at this point, you're probably sitting back going, yeah, it kind of worked out fairly well for me.
I wish I bought a couple. So getting close to final words, do you have advice for people who work full-time, want to continue to work full-time, and invest on the side, hopefully make kind of John Romanes-type money? What would your advice be? Maybe like 3 tips on getting started for people?
Yeah, so you know what? I would say, number one, educate yourself, mm-hmm. right?
But and how?
Okay, so let's focus on point number one, which is education, right? The first thing I would say is you need to first of all figure out, like, you know, how is it that you want to learn? I'm a book learning guy, right? So I bought Real Estate Investing in Canada. I would say starting off with anything by Don Campbell is probably a good way to go. Mm-hmm. If you want to learn more about
books, by the way.
Yeah, so you know, they're written very, very, very easy. You know, it's simple English. It's straight to the point. You know, if you ever have a chance to meet him in real life, Don is just a straight shooter, great guy, very intelligent, very yeah. successful. You know, he practices what he preaches, right? So I would start off by educating yourself. You know, the Rain Acre sessions. I haven't been to one in a little while, but I will say I don't know if they've changed a lot or not. I probably will. I think I went to one a couple of years ago, but good sessions.
Yeah.
I would say, you know, a lot of people, you know, they'll go to Rain and then they'll join and do all the week, yeah. you know, the monthly sessions. But before you invest all that time, I would say, you know, all that time and money, don't expose yourself to analysis paralysis. The more you learn, the longer it's going to take you to get into this, right? I think at some point you just have to pull the trigger. So point number one is educate yourself. Don't go in there blind, right? Point number two is find someone that you trust or someone that you know who's got a proven track record, right? You know, Irwin was calling himself Mr. Hamilton. We had a chance to sit down. He took the time to meet me, talk to me, help me feel secure that this guy knew what he was talking about, right? And
made you a whole shit ton of money.
Yes, made me a whole shit ton of money. And then the third point is just do it, right? Like, there's a million, and I love it when I hear people going, oh, well, I ran the numbers and wasn't quite comfortable. And like, you know what? Just go and do it, right? As long as your property cash flows, even if it's $50 a month, right? Even if it's $100, $50 a month, if it cash flows, go and do it. Because the greatest education you're going to get about, not just about real estate investing, but more importantly, about your own ability to tolerate the ups and downs of real estate investing is by, guess what? Owning a freaking house,
yeah.
right? You own it, then you're going to sit there at night and the first night you're going to lie in bed and go, holy shit, I have 2 mortgages,
yeah.
right? You're gonna sit there and that's what you're going to think about. And then you're going to say, oh my God, you're going to rent it out. And you're going to say, wow, I have, you know, 2 months of money in my hand. Someone paid me first and last check. And then you're going to go, oh my God, I can't sleep at night because there's another human being living in my house. And then you eventually fall asleep. And then you get your first bill that says, oh, you know, $500 for so-and-so repair. And you're like, oh man, this sucks. I got to sell this place. So, I mean, you know, you're never going to learn until you're in it. And it's like people tell me, like, I'm about to become a parent, right? And they say to you, as much as you think you know about it or as much as you think you're going to be prepared,
right.
you never know until you have that child
yes.
how much work it is and how much it changes your life. And with real estate investing, you can plan and analyze and spreadsheet and crunch, but until you actually buy a place and experience the fear of having 2 mortgages mm-hmm. and the rush of mm-hmm. getting a first and last check and the frustration of having to do your first repair or whatever it is, right? Or the joy of refinancing your property for the first time after 5 years. Yeah. Until you experience all that, you're never really going to know what yeah. it's all about.
Dealing with shit.
Yeah.
And then waiting on the long-term end.
That's it, man. So, you know...
Oh, and to add to the child part, like, you won't know until you do it. You will not know this level of love of being a parent until you are a parent.
That's what I keep hearing.
And then when you have a second kid, you're like, well, I thought I knew love, and I'm on this whole new level of love. You won't know until you're there.
Listen to Irwin and me getting philosophical here over a bottle of wine, huh?
Oh yeah, we're drinking, by the way. I don't know if you hear that clinking in the background. That's what it is.
So yeah, we're an hour and 17 minutes in. I hope we've entertained the crowd.
That was just the first tip, though.
Oh, no! I did say three tips, right?
You said three.
Yeah, I said educate yourself, yeah. but don't expose yourself to analysis paralysis.
Yeah.
Number two is make sure that you can find people that you trust that you can work with.
Yeah.
And number three was just freaking do it,
right?
So I mean, those are the three, you know, broad tips, and then we kind of went into each one of them into a little bit of detail.
I would argue your first point, because I think if you study economics and you look at things like. For example, okay, let's look at Hamilton the last 3 years.
Yep.
On average, the last 3 years, average piece of real estate in Hamilton, including condos,
yep.
average price has gone up $3,300. Yeah.
I mean $3,300.
Per month, sorry, per month.
Oh, God, I was thinking, hang on.
Sorry.
I bought really well.
My bad. And over 3 years, average piece of real estate, again, including condos, between January 2014, December 2016... average property's gone up $125,000.
Yep.
And then if you look at the last 12 months, January 2016 to December 2016, average price has gone up $6,300. Right? And you look at other things like economics, we know interest rates are going to stay low. Trump, the American taxpayer, is going to have to pay for that front, at least front the payment for that wall.
Sorry, the wall.
We love Trump. Trump has said he's going to keep interest rates low as long as inflation's in control. We're expecting, so the Ontario Minister of Finance is expecting somewhere around 110,000, 115,000 immigrants to Ontario,
yeah.
which is like essentially the size of St. Catharines,
mm-hmm.
where these people need somewhere to live,
mm-hmm.
continue pressure on our prices. Yeah. So if you do learn too much, like I'm on my end of learning too much, my thinking is you're a fool to hold cash.
Yeah.
If you can buy a house, if you have cash to buy a house comfortably, I think it's foolish.
Yeah. Right?
And so like I'm buying a house this year, you're buying a house this year.
Yeah.
John's nodding.
Yeah, sorry. I'm nodding. I'm it's definitely my life plan. I mean,
yeah.
I'm looking for that next property. Yeah.
Yes. Kids are expensive. I'm buying a second house for my daughter. Then hopefully this year or next year I'll buy a house, another second house for my son, because they're expensive.
Yeah. So cool. Yeah, that was good.
And a final note, because you're talking about pension, but your mom worked for OHIP. Quick final point for me, and I'll shut up. Is it's pretty common. It's been published a couple times throughout the years that. If you do not have a pension, for those of us who do not have pensions, 50% of us will be broke during our retirement years.
Yeah.
As soon as within 12 months of retirement.
Yeah, it's pretty scary.
Ridiculous.
I mean, you know, the coming from a guy who's been saving since he was, you know, 15 years old.
Yeah.
I'm fascinated by the fact that people have so much difficulty. I mean, it's one thing if you're not making a lot of money, but it's. How people aren't putting aside for their future. I mean, gone are the days outside of government of defined benefit pensions, right? I mean, some companies, if you're lucky, at least my company provides a defined contribution for those who want to capitalize on that.
Mm-hmm.
But for everybody else, I mean, you know, there's opportunities out there to find ways to get ready for retirement. And, you know, people are, you know, living longer, right? Not smoking as much, taking better care of their health. I mean, what happens if you retire at 65 and you live till 85,
yeah.
right? What happens if the last 5 years of those you have to be in special care? Are you going to have any money to pay for that, right? So, I mean, people need to think longer term and need to be a little bit more thoughtful about how they approach their retirement.
Right. And I'm not quite sure how this fits in. We're almost finished the bottle. So I'll say it anyways. Like one of my objectives, just one, it doesn't necessarily have to be this, but one of my objectives is to have $2 million of investable capital.
That's
so
good.
So I can give it to Paramount to invest at 10% and make $200,000 a year for doing nothing.
Yeah, doing nothing is nice too, huh?
I don't think either of us are wired to do nothing, but the idea is pretty cool.
It is pretty cool.
And I joke because I honest to goodness want every listener, every reader of mine to be successful in life. And because I'm half kidding and half serious. I'd love for us all to be in retirement age and playing World of Warcraft together. I think it'd be absolutely hilarious.
You don't seem like the World of Warcraft kind of guy.
I'm not right now, because I'm saving that for later. I'd be totally into it. I'd be at least 2 hours a day type guy. And I say that because I say World of Warcraft because we're probably not going to be retiring close to each other.
No.
Good chance we're not retiring close to each other, right? You could be on a Greek island. I could be in Florida. I could be in Costa Rica. I don't know where it is.
Yeah. You know what? If you're going to go to a Greek island to retire, Naxos, that's where I want to go. I keep telling Frida, I go, if I win the lottery, we're moving to Naxos and we're going to...
the lottery.
If I won cash lottery, remember, most of my money's still tied up in those houses, right?
Right.
Cool, buddy.
Oh, and you promised to touch on your other investments.
Oh, great, Greybrook. Okay, so really quickly, I do have a number of investments with Greybrook. I'm in the Colgan project in up there.
Oh, together.
Yeah, yeah. I'm in a project in Cambridge,
mm-hmm.
And actually, those are the two I'm in right now. But I also do some investing through Paramount. So, of course, I have the... I think it pays 10% a year, and you were alluding to that earlier. And I am waiting for my friends over at Greybrook to send me the latest details on a project that's happening out in Durham region. So,
Oshawa, right?
Yes, absolutely, Oshawa. And, that's a nice way, again, to get into the real estate world using your RRSPs. And most of this money is all of that money is in RRSPs or in TFSA.
Mm-hmm.
It's a great way to get into the real estate world, capitalize on the rising price of houses without necessarily having to deal with the tenant component. So
yeah.
I don't look at it as a substitute to what I'm doing. I look at it as another way of investing and by diversifying, right?
Right.
So you got your stocks, you got your, and you're diversifying within them. You got your real estate portfolio diversified within that, right? I've got single family, triplex, I've got student rentals, and then kind of like that last component, which is the investment in development of properties,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's a nice way to stay diversified.
Right. And I'll just add to the point, that point that my friend Michael, who was in my wedding party, so a close friend of mine, obviously, I knew, and he even said himself, he would never be a landlord. So I suggested Greybrook to him.
So, yeah. Very good.
Yeah. So anyone interested in contact for Greybrook, I'll include contact information in the show notes. Cool.
Very cool.
John, it's been a pleasure.
It's been too long. I mean, it was a long time coming that the two of us would come together and enjoy a bottle of wine over a microphone in your dining room, I guess?
Yeah. I'm going to sleep good tonight.
Yeah. I'm starting to feel it too. I had a long day today.
So thanks so much.
My pleasure. You're very welcome.
We can do this again probably next year.
Yeah. Maybe next year we'll have some new stories. I'll talk to you about being a real estate investing full-time working parent.
That'd be cool. And also, sorry, one quick thing. How involved is your wife in your investing, in your real estate investing?
The honest answer?
Yeah.
0%.
Yeah.
0%. It's, so for me, I mean, I've the majority of the houses I owned, everything I owned was accumulated in the years prior to meeting my wife. And, my wife has been very supportive, and her thinking is, hey, listen, you know, this is important to you. You love doing it. It's been great. You know, and I keep her very abreast of what's happening, both in the stock market and with my properties. I mean, she's come out and visited a number of them with me and,
mm-hmm.
you know, she knows where they are and I talk to her about them. But, her opinion is, listen, as long as it doesn't affect us, as long as you're not channeling money to support them, as long as they're taking care of themselves and they're growing.
Which they are.
Yeah, which they are. I'm perfectly fine with it. So you know, my wife is not. She's not. She doesn't have the same inclination around investing, and that's the other thing that's important. I mean, you know, a lot of people. It's one thing to have a wife. You know, you kind of runs the gamut, if you will. You know, you can have a spouse who is completely in it and wants to partner with you. I mean, you and Cherry are partners basically in that, right?
Yeah.
And then, you know, on the other end, I know a lot of people who said, I want to do it, but my spouse is absolutely against it 100%, right? It
doesn't work well.
And you know, that's a point of frustration, and that's obviously something that you need to get them over that hump somehow. And then you have that nice middle where, you know, the spouse is, hey, listen, I mean, if it works great, and as long as it doesn't affect our personal finances, but I don't necessarily need to be involved. Just keep me abreast if anything's, you know, anything really good or really bad happens. Otherwise, Mm-hmm. I'm assuming everything's all right.
Right.
So, yeah.
And if anyone wants to follow up with you, you're on Twitter? I know you're off Facebook.
Oh, I'm Instagram. I'm off Facebook.
You're all over Snapchat.
You know what? I'm a LinkedIn guy.
LinkedIn guy. Okay.
Yeah, yeah. I love LinkedIn. You know, you can look for me, John Romanis. That's with a U R O U M A N I S. You'll see me with my cool glasses and blue blazer in my profile picture.
Excellent. And you'll be on my panel February 18th?
Yes, I am on your panel February 18th. Yeah, great. I'm looking forward to it.
So for those of you who want to meet John in person, you know, he's a real person. I didn't pay him to say any of these things. The fact that I made him a lot of money, helped make him a lot of money. He's the one assuming all the risk. It's his name on title and mortgage. But he will be speaking at my event February 18th, mrhamilton.ca/innercircle. Again, it'll be on my show notes if you want to talk to him, bend his ear, all those sorts of fun things. All right. Thank you, John.
Thank you, Erwin.
It's been a pleasure. We got to do dinner soon. I want to see Frida.
Yeah, I'm sure she wants to see you guys too.
That'd be awesome. Thank you, John.
You're welcome.
Before you go, if you are like other investors, you enjoy hanging out with like-minded people, but where do you go? When I started out, it felt lonely being a real estate investor because my friends, coworkers, and family were not much help. And what they had to share was often negative, such as, you'll be a slumlord, or they asked stupid questions like, what if the bubble bursts? So I went to meetups, but stopped soon after as attendees didn't take things seriously enough or lack experience to share. It was like the blind leading the blind. Later, I started these monthly networking meetings in Oakville, Ontario, called the Mr. Hamilton Inner Circle, where we have incredible guest speakers like the ones on this podcast. I share the latest economic fundamentals that apply to our investing and best practice lessons you can only learn from being an investor. If you want to be a real estate insider, these meetings are for you. So if you want to come, learn, and share, go to www.mrhamilton.ca/innercircle. But register soon, as I kid you not, we have a waitlist each month for these meetings. Thank you for listening, and I hope to meet you soon.